Great pleasure to actually give a talk here since I've been hanging around for quite a while. Lately I've been working with Kendrick on Chime fast radio burst stuff, but today I'm going to talk about my day job stuff, working on DESI. And I'm actually going to focus kind of mostly on the nuts and bolts, like the engineering and technology side of the project. Partly because if I try to tell you about the science side of the project, the people in the room are going to know a lot more about it than I will. So forgive me the very shallow look into the science. I'll kind of use that a little bit to motivate it, but really not go very deep there. and then kind of dive into the nuts and bolts of the DESI project. And then briefly at the end, tell you a little bit about what I'm actually working on, so the parts that I can actually speak to with some knowledge. About I think it's a coyote. They're the harmless creatures that can be found on the mountaintop. We also have mountain lions that are not harmless. the mountain lions can kill you. The coyotes are just decorative for humans, at least. No, not really. Just this. They commissioned an artist to do the logo and. He came up with this rather colorful one. The only objection people had to it is that the telescopes stick out of the dome. Yeah, exactly. You don't want that. okay, so DESI is really a galaxy mapping project. And I'm going to sort of show you the generations of galaxy mapping projects, kind of three generations worth. So this is the galaxy map two generations back from DESI, the 2DF survey from 2003. And each of these little dots is, of course, a galaxy. This is redshift scale. So this is looking out at a swath of sky and seeing that galaxies aren't uniformly distributed through space. Of course, they cluster. And aside from that very clear large-scale structure, there's another little gem of information in the way they're distributed, which is the baryon acoustic oscillation. Now, again, like probably everybody in the room knows at least as much as I do about this topic, but I found Daniel Eisenstein's illustration of this really clear, and it really tied it together in the most obvious way that I've seen explained so far. So this is looking at, this will look over time at one little blob of overdensity in the early universe. So this is at very high redshift, 110 years after the inflationary period or Big Bang. And we're looking at, so the thing that's plotted is the mass profile, like relative mass profile. So it's not it doesn't take into account that there's more dark matter than the other stuff. And the radius scale is in co-moving, so it's the size it will have today. Okay, so this is looking at a little blob of overdensity. And then after, so the first thing that happens is that the dark matter doesn't really care, it's just drawn by it's only paying attention to the gravitational attraction. So it basically hangs out around the Earth, around that initial overdensity. The gas and like hydrogen and photons they started out being like a really overdense region and they start expanding out like a cloud of gas. So they start expanding out. Now, this is mass profile, so in density, it's actually still dense near the core and it's just pushing out. But this is showing you sort of where the mass is with respect to radius. Meanwhile, the neutrinos are basically just taking off. And then as this proceeds, you get essentially the same thing still happening. The dark matter is hanging around the core. The gas and photons are pushing out in this bubble, and the neutrinos are kind of mostly taking away, until this magical instant when, at about 380,000 years, when at recombination when now the photons and the gas aren't so strongly coupled, and the photons start being able to move independently of the gas. So they now start to take off. And also at this point, the hydrogen is not able to move as fast, so it basically gets frozen in at this point. Okay, so the next step, quite a bit further along, the photons and gas are streaming away. The photons at that last instant are basically what we'll see as the cosmic microwave background. And then over time, essentially the hydrogen and dark matter start to equilibrate a little bit. So this is much further in the future at redshift 80, and then by redshift 10, they're basically matched again. So what we're left with is the initial overdensity and then this little bump at 150 megaparsecs. So I thought the thing I like about this is it nicely ties together what you see in the CMB and what you see today and sort of what all the components were doing at each point in time. So I really like that illustration. So there's a little animated GIF, because this is from like 15 years ago, showing this whole process. Yes. Right. Yeah, exactly. Or they sort of, they're co-attracted gravitationally. Okay, so then I said that was looking at mass. This is the same version, the same thing, but in density units now. So you see there still indeed is a really high peak at the core. And then this little bump that looked very prominent in that previous plot, we can see is now many orders of magnitude down in density. So that's why we don't really see it as a very obvious thing on the sky. It's a really small overdensity with respect to any dark matter peak. So, and of course, this was looking at a single initial overdensity. And the early universe was covered with a bunch of these initial overdensities. So what we see is a superposition of all of these things, where around each galaxy, there's at a 150 megaparsecs, there's a slightly larger chance of finding another galaxy. Okay, so as I said before, there are kind of two magical instances here. I guess I'm spending kind of too long belaboring this point, but there are kind of two magical instances. One is when at recombination, when the CMB is generated, and then kind of present day when we have these galaxy overdensities. Okay, so that's really all okay. I was kind of madly rearranging my slides because this is only the second time I've given this kind of talk, so I'm still kind of figuring out what the narrative arc is. So I guess in the CMB, you get multiple you see it in the power spectrum as multiple peaks. Your question was, why do we think about it in real space? People use either for BAO. I find real space just easier to think about because I'm weak in the brain.
Okay.
Right, okay, yeah, good. I don't really know. That could be. There is a lot of power in an effective illustration, and it, you know, at least for me, it's easier to, I can see what's happening in
Before that,
real
it
space.
wasn't the same
That could well be. Daniel is a surprisingly polarizing figure. Okay, so you know, as I said, this, as I've been, I now realize, belaboring, this BAL kind of nicely gives you two things. One is that this kind of characteristic scale of the CMB, which then forms into large-scale structure in galaxies, and then, of course, gives you this slight overdensity when we measure the location, the positions of galaxies. So this is the measurement of exactly this slight overdensity of galaxies in the BOSS survey, which is the current generation or generation before DESI. So this is great, and the nice thing about the BAO is that it's basically, we know that it's a standard ruler. You know, it was laid down by perturbations in the early universe, and then essentially the galaxies will form where there were overdensities of dark matter and gas, and they're not affecting the size of the universe, they're just along for the ride. So essentially, if you can measure the size, the angular size of the BAO feature at different redshifts, you can chart the growth of the universe over time. So it's really nice in that it's a pretty clean probe, like it's a pretty clean kind of geometrical measurement of the size of the universe. Whereas, say, supernovae also let you chart out the size of the universe, but it's really in terms of the luminosity size. It's like how much fainter objects become if you think that they started out the same brightness. So the BAO is kind of nice in that it has, it's kind of very, it's pretty simple, the analysis, or the number of steps from observables to measured thing. Okay, so this is great, but this is a measurement of the BAO at a single redshift. And of course, with dark energy, we'd really like to know what's going on with over time, over cosmic time. So we'd like to be able to chart precisely the size of the universe at different redshift instants. So galaxy redshift surveys have a Moore's law of their own. It's much slower than the Moore's law for chips. basically, they tend to get about 10 times bigger every 10 years. So if we can finish DESI by 2024, we'll stay on the curve. It's great. And as David Schlegel, from whom I stole this slide, likes to say, by 2061, we'll have mapped all, essentially all observable galaxies. So at the this is, I think, at the density of the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. If you had a spectrum for each of those, that would be 160 million over the sky. 140 billion over the sky. What's a three orders of magnitude? in order to stay on this curve, we need to collect 10 times more galaxy spectra than SDSS did. All right, so here's the map before SDSS. Now, yeah.
I'm just wondering, who are the contenders for keeping the curve up? Or are there contenders?
Are there competitors, you mean, for
Yeah, basically that. Basically, put that point there and we'll be others.
Okay, that's interesting. So this is these are just galaxy redshift surveys, right? Another way you can try to measure the BAO is not by measuring galaxies, but by measuring gas, right? So instead of measuring, exactly. So you can see that I'm hedging my bets just in what I work on. pardon me? Yeah, so BOSS is part of the SDSS 3 project. Yeah, exactly. So with CHIME, instead of measuring individual galaxies, you measure the intensity of hydrogen gas directly. And at many different redshifts at once, for CHIME, roughly redshifts 1 to 2. The problem is that that's mixed in with a huge amount of foregrounds. So the real challenge there is figuring out the foregrounds.
Okay, other than that, there's nothing else?
At the scale of DESI, not really. It costs about $50 million, so it's not a really, it's something that only a certain number of things of projects can achieve. Yeah, so I think there are some other projects putting stars on the map, but not really at this next step. I think that's true. Yeah, so DESI, the aim is to be on Sky 2019, and the survey will run for about 5 years. Okay, so here's that map I showed before, and then here's the roughly factor of 10 in size that SDSS made beyond that. So SDSS mapped this huge swath of galaxies up between about redshift 0.5 to 0.7, and those were the ones from which that BAO measurement was made. and then in addition to that, they mapped a bunch of high redshift quasars. So the without going into too much detail, these allow you to measure the BAO in the Lyman Alpha forest. So the quasars are acting as backlights, illuminating the hydrogen gas. So this is sort of encroaching on the CHIME territory, where instead of measuring individual galaxies, you measure amount of hydrogen gas along that line of sight. In the SDSS and BOSS worlds, those quasars are fairly sparse. So most of the power comes from looking along the line of sight. In the DESI regime, they're dense enough you can look between lines of sight and really get a three-dimensional map of the hydrogen gas at these high redshifts. Very low signal to noise. Okay, so here's the nice thing about DESI is that we fill in this whole missing region. So we're pushing to a considerably higher redshift to really map out this this time when dark energy really turns on and takes over. Okay, and the color map doesn't really mean anything. It's just saying we're putting a bunch of galaxies there. That's interesting. There should be a plot here. Okay. So as far as BAO measurements before DESI, these really just have the SDSS and BOSS measurements. So those millions of galaxies end up being one data point on this plot. 10 years of work measuring the Lyman Alpha forest ends up being another data point on this plot. So you know, BAO is a clean probe, but it is a lot of work. because again, the overdensity is pretty small. So it's a pretty small, kind of delicate statistical signal. Here's what we want to do with DESI. Boom, just kind of lay down dozens of points, dozens of measurements along this curve of measuring the expansion rate with respect to redshift. so you can see that there are a few different kind of regions here, like there's these ones, and these ones, and those correspond to different classes of galaxies, different types of galaxies that can be targeted at different redshift ranges. I think at this point, can I take any questions about that side? Because I'm going to talk now, kind of dive into the technology side a little bit now. Okay, So basically, in order to make this this measurement, we need to collect a lot of redshifts. And I want to tell you, sort of give you a sense for why we can't just do what SDSS did, but more. And give you a sense of kind of what the limitations are and how we have to move to different technology to make this achievement. So the Sloan Digital Sky Survey that conducted the SDSS and BOSS spectroscopic surveys uses this dedicated 2.5 meter telescope. And it started out way back when having an imager, a camera on it. That camera is now in the basement of the Smithsonian. So the first thing SDSS did was take images, and then from those detected stars and galaxies and decided which ones were interesting for follow-up. And then in order to take spectra of these, what we have to do is decide which objects we want to observe, and then take an aluminum plate, drill holes in it with a precision drilling machine at the University of Washington, put them in a FedEx box, ship them to Arizona, and then a group of skilled staff members individually plug fiber optic cables into each of those 1,000 holes per plate. So over the years, yeah, those are ones where wanted to, something was selected there, and then when we took a spectrum of it, it turned out to be nothing there. So they might be asteroids or noise or whatever else. For whatever reason, they ended up being. Here I've shown what we actually, I'm cheating here because I showed what we actually measured, not what we thought we were going to see there. So some of these things were targeted as one class of object and turned out to be another. So one thing we get is, I don't know if there are any on this sheet, but sometimes we target something as a quasar and it ends up being a star.
What does it
lousy stars. It doesn't really so much. Yeah, so we drill a hole in the aluminum plate. So each of these little guys is a hole drilled in the plate. So there's 1,000 per plate, and over 2 million, 3 million were collected. So there's like this whole process. So people have individually plugged 3 million fibers. Right? It's quite remarkable. It's a labor-intensive process. So over the years, they've gotten pretty fast. I'm kidding. It actually takes them, I don't know, half an hour or something per plate. It's really time-intensive. And you can see there are these little regions. These fibers are only so long, so each it's not that each fiber has to be plugged into a particular hole, but each bundle of 10 has to go into a particular region. So when we asked these staff members what would happen if we tried to do this 10 times bigger, oops, sorry, how do I go to the next page? They said the budget in Band-Aids alone would bankrupt us. Okay, so obviously something different is going to have to be used if we want to collect 10 times more redshifts. Oh yeah, so the other thing is I wanted to just show you very quickly a bit of a night of operations on SDSS. Oh, it's got a nice sound. Okay, apparently I can't turn off the sound, so we'll enjoy the cello. Thank you. droppings on them. Maybe, I mean, to a barn sparrow, a telescope dome might look an awful lot like a barn. I don't actually know how that is handled. So anyway, the thing to take away from that is that the Sloan process of observing a new part of the sky is pretty laborious and has a fair bit of overhead. And not going to tell you exactly what the solution is just yet, but I'll give you a hint that it's a robot army. and I'll take you through the path of the light in the DESI project. So step one of running a sky survey is get a telescope. So we found this one at the very top, the Mayall 4-meter telescope on Kitt Peak. So this is a good thing to start out with. It's bigger than the Sloan telescope. So if we want to collect 10 times more spectra, it's good to start with a bigger telescope. And now, so this building is vast. It was built in the 70s when ideas about telescopes were a little bit different. But it's very high. It's like 12 stories off above the peak of the mountain, so it's very high up. Pardon? To get above the ground layer of air, essentially. And I think in current site design views, you wouldn't put it at the very top of the ridge, because the sort of air coming over the ridge is more messy than you would get in other places on the peak. So LSST, for example, isn't right on the ridge. It's in a different kind of part of the mountain. But anyway, this is so inside this big dome is the mount that holds the telescope. And so here are a kind of sketch of the DESI system. So 4-meter primary mirror, a big set of lenses that form, that yield a wide angle focal surface, so giving a large field of view so that we can observe a lot of galaxies at the same time. A robot army, which I'll come to in a second, from which come 5,000 fiber optic cables. Now in Sloan, the spectrographs were mounted on the telescope. So as the telescope was moving around, the spectrographs were flopping around. Also, they're exposed to ambient temperature, so it was harder to calibrate them. In DESI, instead of doing that, we take 250 kilometers of fiber, cut it into 50-meter pieces, and thread it delicately through this telescope. The telescope moves on two axes, so you have to be kind of careful around the joints. And that leads down to a little climate-controlled room with isolated optical benches that will hold the spectrographs. So the idea is that they'll be much easier to calibrate than the SDSS ones were. Which helps with the data analysis and improves the signal to noise. So it gives us another little edge for getting up to this factor of 10 more galaxies. Yeah, so the biggest thing is focal ratio degradation, I guess. As you bend them too much, you broadens the cone of light coming out the end. So there's kind of there's a bunch of mechanical engineering essentially to try to prevent the fiber bundles from ever bending at too tight an angle. This is stock telecommunications fiber. You buy it on big spools, but winding it into these manageable and kind of protected fiber bundles is something of quite a large task, actually. It's how the UK is buying in, or Durham, or some group of universities in the UK are buying in by virtue of building these cable assemblies. OK, so I'm now going to just sort of show you little pictures of each of these parts. So these are the corrector lenses that kind of form the focal plane. And it's like taller than I am, and weighs a lot. And has these rather extreme optical surfaces. So even this kind of very conventional part of the project is actually like pretty pretty extreme. And they're... I think it's too hard. It would be too hard to form the optical path with mirrors because it has six focusing elements, and it also has an atmospheric dispersion corrector, so it tries to correct for the different dispersion, the difference of how the atmosphere affects red and blue light rays. So, you know, this is very similar to the corrector lens on like the Subaru telescope for HSC or for a dark energy camera. But you know, even several of these mirrors are larger than a meter across and have these weird surfaces. So they've actually been quite challenging for the vendors to coat.
So I mean, that's not, I guess the problem is different colors actually go through different paths, so you don't actually see the
back. Well, these. Yeah, don't know the details, but so it is indeed in SDSS the focal surfaces for the for red and blue rays are slightly different heights, and in fact, in one phase of the project, they used little washers for the quasars to move the fibers into a different height on the focal plane. Which she added to the already labor-intensive process. Yes, yeah. There's a corrector lens on front of the camera. And actually, both SDSS and DESI have slightly curved focal planes as well. Okay. So anyway, so here we finally get to the robot army. So this is kind of, in many ways, this is the most challenging part of the DESI project and the real technology step that makes it possible. So we're going to cram 5,000 fibers onto the focal plane. So here's just a kind of mapping of them. And initially the plan was to do this with one, as one piece of aluminum, but it turns out to be just too hard to mill and manage. So it's split into 10 of these little segments, each of which has 500 holes drilled through. And it turns out that actually doing the mechanical modeling of a piece of aluminum with that many holes in it is not totally standard. Like they had to do special modeling to figure out how it would flex under load and behave thermally. So it was like, even like the thing that just holds the fibers is kind of an engineering project. So through each of these holes, is placed one of these little fiber robots. So I have a video of them moving, but basically within this package are two little 4 millimeter diameter motors with little gear assemblies that allow this thing to move in two axes. So one of them moves this top part, rotates the top part, and then there's another motor in the top that rotates the very tip, and the fiber goes up to there. So then the fiber is here, and you can move it within these two axes, concentric circles, that allow you to place the fiber anywhere within within that footprint, and actually a little bit outside of that, the footprint of that little fiber robot. And then, that single fiber will come out the back and thread its way through the telescope and down to the spectrographs. So unlike SDSS, where we had the freedom to place fibers kind of basically where we wanted on the focal plane, in DESI they each patrol a little area, and within the area that they can reach, we have to choose a star or galaxy to observe. Okay, so this one could use some sound to go with it, like maybe the the flight of the Valkyries or something. But here you can see them moving the outer part, and then I think they move the inner part too. These ones are test models, so they don't actually have fibers installed. But basically, that's the. Yeah, so these things will get plugged through. Sorry, I should go. I'll just go back to that. So each of these will get screwed into that piece of aluminum like a spark plug. So the fibers will, and these black tips will stick out and present the fibers to the sky. And then the fibers will come out the back end and down to the spectrographs. Yeah, that's right. So you can, by rotating the outer motor and then the inner motor, you can position the fiber to hit a single galaxy.
How many spectrometers
do you have? So 10 spectrographs.
So you can take only 10 galaxies?
No. Each one has 500 fibers projected onto it. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So each of the holes in there will have one of these little robots in it, and that will have one fiber that will go down to one spectrograph, or, 500 of which will go down to one spectrograph. essentially this lets us collect 5,000 spectra at a time, and the whole thing can be reconfigured within a couple of minutes. The motors don't have any encoders or anything like that. They're just they're DC brushless motors. So basically, you turn them on for a amount of time, they spin, and then we have to shine light back through the fibers, observe them with a camera, see where all of the fibers ended up, and then fine tune them by moving them again. But this whole process takes a few minutes. Yeah. Yeah, there's a camera that observes the focal plane. Yeah, it's pretty neat. That whole process takes a couple of minutes. Compare that to SDSS, where that end-to-end, that process took weeks. So it's pretty neat. It really is a game changer to be able to reconfigure it in kind of real time.
And how long do you observe one galaxy?
Around 15 minutes, thereabouts.
So the places between those holes, they are kind of, I guess, the gaps in the spectra?
Not quite, because this part is slightly larger than that part. So, in the next slide, this is where each fiber tip can reach. They can slightly overlap, so they reach a little bit outside of their footprint, we can hit each part of the focal plane with at least one fiber, two in a very small fraction. So you can see that, you can maybe kind of see that as you plug in more of the positioners, this focal plane becomes kind of densely forested with these fibers. These are little protectors that cover the fiber tips because they're very delicate. And then out the back comes this huge mess of cables that will be, I'm sure, very neatly zap-strapped together and tightly rooted. Right. Okay, so this is just very briefly the root of those long fiber bundles that traverse 50 meters from the top of the telescope down, carefully going through the two axes of where the telescope rotates and down into the little climate-controlled room that will hold the spectrographs themselves. You look like you have another question. go ahead. I have... the spectrographs themselves have three arms, so we want to collect a quite a broad wavelength range. And in order to do that most efficiently or effectively, it's nice to split it into three different bands, each of which has its own camera. So the light comes in, gets collimated, and then split twice with dichroics, and then goes into individual near-infrared blue and red cameras. Yeah, so each of these has 500 fibers lined up this way and then dispersed that way. So each camera images 500 spectra, two-dimensional, yeah, and pretty densely packed. They're, that's just a CAD version of the same thing. They're 4K by 4K devices, so the spectra are like, you know, 8 pixels apart away from each other. So the images look something like that at the top right. This is, I think, a sky spectrum, so they're all basically seeing the same thing traced out. So each of those, each column is a fiber, and that's the spectral direction. So each of the red parts would be one sky line, like one emission line from the night sky. And added to that are the galaxy spectra that we care about. This is a simulation, so I don't know if it actually has the galaxy spectra added in or not. The chips are also basically the newest technology. They're very, at least the red and infrared ones, they're 250 micron thick devices manufactured at Berkeley Lab. And they have an artisanal shop. Yeah, they have a foundry. In fact, they have also been experimenting with germanium chips. So they've been really, this is for the David Schlegel's next step is to push further into the infrared by using germanium instead of silicon. But that's still very much an R&D effort. So then after collecting the spectra, they go off into supercomputer land, about which I won't really talk today. We're fortunate enough to be funded by the Department of Energy, so we get to use the Department of Energy supercomputing facility, NERSC. And this is the assembly of their current latest and greatest machine, Cori. Oh, it's the supercomputer that was most recently built at NERSC, the supercomputing facility. So that's really all I had to say about the DESI technology itself. So these are the targets we observe. So we really care about the galaxies, the bottom three target classes. So luminous red galaxies, very similar to the SDSS luminous red galaxies, but going a little bit further and fainter, that are your kind of typical old red, bright, massive galaxies. They're good tracers because they really follow the highest peaks in the dark matter density. Further out, those become too faint, so we have to look at these emission line galaxies, which are basically vigorously star-forming galaxies. And they're harder to select, but they have a nice, some nice clean indicators of star formation, like there's an oxygen 2 line or pair of lines that, if you measure it, gives you a very firm redshift determination. And then a bunch of quasars that both themselves trace the density field and also serve as backlights for Lyman Alpha Forest at higher redshifts. So that all happens during the dark time, and then the top two target classes have basically been added on of what we do in the bright time, which is measure a bunch of nearby galaxies, so basically extending the Sloan main sample out to redshift 0.4, and then a bunch of stars.
So how long would that take?
5 years is the plan.
And you said earlier 15 minutes for
yes, yeah, something that's a good question that I should know the answer to better. It's roughly 15 minutes, yeah.
So you have 5,000 galaxies per 15 minutes.
Yes, that's right. Some of them take more than one exposure. Some of them are. So the quasars, I forget the details exactly, but especially the Lyman alpha quasars, the more signal to noise you can accumulate, the more you get out of them. The rest of them, you just need a redshift and then you're done. So if they turn out to be bright or have strong emission lines or whatever, and you get them on the first pass, then you're done. Can move on to another target within that fibrous patrol radius. Some of them take multiple exposures before you get anything out of them. So there's an elaborate planning process there.
Can you change the aperture angle on the fiber optic
thing? Nope, they're all fixed.
So what's the point of stretch out a star? What are
the time? People like. I can't really argue about that. I mean, I guess look at metallicity gradients, calibrators. I don't really know, actually.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's some sort of calibration or is there some sort of scientific question?
There is, but I couldn't really tell you. I couldn't describe it for you. I mean, I think they're looking at different chemistry and dynamics of different stellar populations. That's when I have to start hand waving more vigorously. Okay, so anyway, I should wrap up, but I'm going to take about 5 more minutes to just talk about what I'm actually doing, which is, remember I said in SDSS, the first step was to take images from which to draw galaxies for spectroscopic follow-up. Now, we want to do the same thing, but for fainter targets. So as a result, we need fainter imaging. We need more sensitive imaging. And that's what I've been working on. So we're currently in the process of running these imaging surveys with basically the telescopes we could find and use. Now, DESI will be in the north, but it turns out that the dark energy camera in the south in Chile at Cerro Tololo is so powerful that it's really valuable to use, even if we have to be looking way to the north to observe the parts of sky that we care about for DESI.
Where is DESI going to be?
DESI's going to be in Arizona at Kitt Peak on the MALE telescope. okay, so we do a bunch of the imaging from Chile. And then we're currently using the MALE telescope, the one that DESI will go on, to measure the Z band. And then a neighboring telescope, the Bach 90 prime, to collect the G and R bands. So these G, R, and Z, Z, provide enough, along with the Y's, infrared imaging, provide enough information to select targets for DESI follow-up. So, 2 weeks ago, I was at Chile for a week for an observing run. We're basically on the MALE telescope nearly every night for the next 6 months or so. So on a good night, on a good morning, I get three successful observing reports from these three telescopes. We only get time on DECAM rather rarely because we're competing with the Dark Energy Survey who built the camera and get a lot of time as a result. But we get a few of their scraps and make very good use of it.
And for the target selection, you couldn't even pick this
thing? Nothing's deep enough. We need to go about 2 magnitudes deeper than Sloan. Pan-STARRS isn't that deep. Nothing else covers that much area. Because we're trying to hit basically 14,000 square degrees. It can observe from the north in the galactic caps, So yeah, so we're basically doing the northern part of the footprint, the magenta part with those two northern telescopes, and then that blue and bright green part with the dark energy camera from the south. And avoiding the galactic plane, of course, because it's just too much of a mess there. Too many stars, too much dust. So that leaves us only ones that are in other galaxies. Yeah, there's still lots of stars in there. A bit, but not too much. But so basically, we're in the midst of doing this imaging survey. We're closing in on finishing our fourth data release that will include the first data from the northern surveys. We've done three data releases with data from the south. The goal will be to have 14,000 square degrees to pretty deep depths, like more than two magnitudes deeper than Sloan. In our last data release, we measured 500 million sources. So that's about the same size as the Sloan survey. This our fourth data release will push us above that. So then we'll be definitely exceeding that. And for each source, we also measure the flux in the WISE imaging. So for each source, we have GRZ and two infrared bands. Well, four infrared bands, but two infrared bands that are deep and that we care about. And one kind of different thing about this is it's essentially a fully public survey. The images are immediately public when they come off the telescope. There's no proprietary period. And we've been trying to do these frequent data releases. Essentially, the feeling is that we only need them for DESI targeting, but they should be useful for a lot of other things. So if we can just kind of provide them to the community, have people use them, get feedback, that'll improve our use and also increase the legacy value of the data set and hopefully make time allocation committees more willing to give us time on the telescopes. Thank you. But yeah, I was going to show you. I'll just before. Oh yeah, right. It won't. That's okay. Fine. We have this nice little interactive viewer of our data as well as the Sloan. So I like this little series where this is the SDSS imaging, the objects that SDSS took spectra of. Our imaging, which is not easy to see on the projector, but considerably deeper. You see, if you actually look at it on the web, you can see that it's a lot. You see a lot more objects. And then here are the objects that we want to follow up with DESI. So you can see amongst the handful of scattered SDSS objects, there's this kind of dense set of galaxies that we want to observe with DESI. Okay, really, thank you now. And I'd be more than happy with any additional questions.
Can I ask a potentially dumb one?
Yeah, of course. Those are my favorite.
SDSS, you said that all the cables that was put in by the fibers are put in by hand. It doesn't matter which one goes where, as long as they're in the right place.
Yeah.
How do you then match each stuff into the target?
They do. There's a machine that runs from the plate, the fibers come down into slit heads and go into the spectrograph, and they take a laser and shine it along the fibers while taking a movie of the focal plane. And basically, as it goes along each fiber, you see bing, 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 them light up in sequence. And that's how they determine which fiber got plugged away.
Thank you.
David Schlegel built that machine, and he's very proud of it.
On that note, the people who were planting the fibers, have they lost their jobs now, given that?
That is a good question.
I imagine that kind of a skill, there aren't too many places.
The Sloan Survey is intending to seek funding to do a fifth round. So there will continue to be...
There will be more plates and more funding, is that? Okay.
Although I think the next round is intended to be mostly infrared observing, which tends to, I think, have fewer fibers. So they might get a bit of a break. But they're also operating in the set. So, I think their fingers will forgive them if they have to seek other work.
So you're not making grad students do it?
No.
You can't trust graduate students with precision for
that. Some people on the project have plugged a few plates, but I think it's mostly a novelty. SGSS employs a staff of observers rather than having collaboration members do it.
Kind of related to that. How warm does it get? The little robot arm thing.
I ask this question every time we have a collaboration meeting because I believe the peak power per robot is 1 watt.
You've got like how many?
5,000. So the lights dim, and but basically there's a box with. It'll have probably chilled water or something to draw heat out of it.
The risk that you'll have like 2 minutes to set it up and then wait an hour before you can expose it?
No, there's a plan to have kind of a slight under pressure in the box behind the focal plane to draw air through. Yeah, to basically ensure that the heat doesn't really cause any trouble. But yeah, that's an astute question.
If the project is already 50 million, why can't you also just build the perfect telescope? It would be a smaller part of the project.
Yeah, telescopes are pretty expensive.
So good. So a telescope like the one you use, do you know what it costs?
No. But it's in, it must be in the same kind of ballpark. I mean, I know the LSST, it's hard to separate the camera and the telescope, but it's hundreds of millions of dollars. It's a bigger telescope.
Well, if I want to compare this with Euclid and WFIRST missions, this would be better for Yale, or those would be better for them. What is the advantage of this?
That is a really good question. I guess those are both really lensing-focused missions. other people in the room probably know.
Do they have a spectra?
Euclid has a low-resolution prism in the near-infrared. So I think they get, what does that give them? BAO at higher redshift, I guess? Whereas I think really most of the missions lensing, which I guess measures different combinations of the cosmological parameters.
But
it's
do better
than
BAO.
Yeah, I think that's the case.
That's the same redshift span.
Also a good question, but I don't know exactly. I actually don't know offhand. I started working on Euclid, so I should have been like studying up on DESI science. but essentially all these, it tends to be that the combination of these projects yield better constraints than individual ones because the degeneracies are just different. So DESI, the primary thing is BAO, but also redshift space distortion ends up being really powerful. So then you get to trace growth of structure as well. And you get constraints on neutrino mass and other things like that.
Lama aquifers. Lama aquifers?
Yeah. I'm not sure actually where the constraints on the treatment mass come from most strongly.
No, but just in general, just from Lama aquifers, it depends on the AO. I guess what you mentioned, right?
Yeah. So both from the galaxies and from the AO.
Okay.
Thank you. Just go to lunch. Thank you.